Hey everyone, it's Brian, and today I have something special for you. One of my all-time favorite podcasts is called Song Exploder. It's a show hosted by Hrishikesh Hirway, where musicians take apart their songs and piece by piece tell the story of how they were made. On Song Exploder, an artist will break down a single song and discuss the sounds and stories that went into that piece. This is an homage to that show. But since this is Talk of the Table and we focus on tabletop role-playing games and actual play, we're going to be diving into the music of one of the best actual play shows ever made, Worlds Beyond Number.
This is the sound of Worlds Beyond Number.
Worlds Beyond Number premiered in early 2024 and immediately altered the actual play landscape. More than being just another D&D podcast, no pun intended, Worlds Beyond Number was part actual play and part audio drama with lush, immersive sound design and a fully original orchestral score. The cast was a murderer's row of performers: Brennan Lee Mulligan, Abria Iyengar, Lou Wilson, and Erica Ishii, a quartet of some of the most seasoned and sought-after D&D stars on the planet, now together to tell a shared story. Their first major campaign was called The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One. But there was also a fifth member of the team that would elevate the cast performance to the next level and transmute the story of Suvi, Ame, and Ursulon into a sweeping epic. That person was Taylor Moore. Taylor had cut his teeth producing beloved actual play shows like Rude Tales of Magic, Fun City, and Oh These, Those Stars of Space. But with Worlds Beyond Number, he strove to make something more grand than he had ever attempted before, even learning music production and composition whole cloth along the way. Today, he is releasing an album of original music from Book 1 of The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One. It contains well over 100 tracks and is available now at bandcamp.com for just $12. You can find the link in the show notes below. In this episode, we are discussing music from throughout the series, but focusing on three tracks: Flight to Haverward, Sarazmir, and Caro. This episode contains some spoilers for Book 1 of The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One.
I knew Brennan from doing comedy stuff in New York coming up through the UCB, and we had met each other that way. And then I had gotten involved in one of his D&D home games. And I had been telling him for a long time that he has to do this professionally. He has to, I think even the first time I was at his table and he was my dungeon master, I stayed after class. I like did the thing where I sort of hung back and let everybody else leave the room. And then I was like, hey, bud, look, I don't know much, but I know what's good. And the fact that you can do that, you've got to find a way to do that for money. You've got to do, if you can do that, you should never have a month where you don't think you can pay rent. But the world wasn't ready yet. A few years later, of course, Dimension 20 launched and the rest is history. But even during that time, we knew that we wanted to do a project together. But eventually, the wheel turns, and years later, we had both come to a place where the project sort of presented itself. He was coming up with this idea of an actual play podcast with some folks that he had met from doing Dropout stuff, Bria and Lou and Erica, and they were looking for a producer. And in the interim, I had started making actual play podcasts. I was making Fun City and Rude Tales of Magic and Oh These, Those Stars of Space.
Come inside, hang up your coat, put your feet by the fire, and I shall bring you what you so desperately seek. Rude Tales of Magic.
And it was going great. Things were doing very well. But one thing that I had been experimenting with was making my own music, because I had been making all these shows and I was mostly producing Rude Tales, and I was using public domain music, old classical music and things like that. And I love that. I love like music making essentially playlists, right? Playlists are just fun to make. And putting music with narrative is just so much fun. And I loved it. But I was bumping up against this feeling of I wanted the music to do exactly what I wanted it to do. Because even with the best choice of a song, you are limited in what that song is. And I really wanted it to be exact. And so I was like taking Ravel pieces and like slicing off the treble and the bass and then remixing them into, or, you know, and like fading the song into different parts of itself and combining compositions and essentially taking all this music apart and then reassembling it. And this is back before I knew about like production libraries where you can get stems. And when you say stems, that means you get like the different instrument tracks of a whole song and you can recombine them like that. I didn't know you could do that. And also I didn't have any money. I couldn't afford to buy it. So we were just sort of building my own and we cutting all these songs together and things like that. And I was at one point, I was just like, well, I got to figure out how to make my own. Also, we were recording and producing all these shows in Audacity, which is a little audio editing program that can't do, at the time, it could not do very much. You could not really make music in Audacity. You could record music to it. And so I thought, I have to learn how to use professional audio editing software. I have to. And it's the only way I'm going to be able to make music. And so I started learning Pro Tools, which is like this industry standard audio editing nightmare that has ruled and ruined my life for the last 4 years. And learning that was the hardest 6 months of my life. But at the same time, in case that was too easy, I was also learning how to write and create music. And around that time, right as that's happening, I'm talking to Brennan and I'm talking to the rest of the world, what will become the World's Beyond Number cast, about doing the show. And I think I had written like 2 cues for Rude Tales, just like the simplest, easiest things. And I told the World's Beyond Number cast, hey, I can do it. I can write an original score for the whole show. No problem. In hindsight, that might have been a very liberal promise. I mean, it worked out fine, I guess, but it was an incredibly difficult 6 months learning all this at the same time. But at the end of it, I was able to put together podcasts with original orchestral scoring, bare bones, but it worked. And that is when I was making the very first thing you hear of Worlds Beyond Number. In the episode Preludes, episode 0, where we meet the heroes for the very first time as they're very young children, and that first thing you hear, the snow falling on endless white sand, that horn blast, and Suvi's desperate escape from the Citadel that begins the whole story, that was the first piece that I made for Worlds Beyond Number, sort of as an audition. Rude Tales was a maximalist endeavor, right? Like, we had a lot of sound design, especially as the show went on, a lot of music. It is meant to be a very thick, funny, full, immersive experience. I didn't really see anyone doing that in audio fiction, in actual play, in podcasting at the time. I just didn't see it. I also just wasn't seeing it anywhere, right? There wasn't a TV show that felt like that. There weren't movies that felt like that. So it was fun to do that sort of thing. And I saw in Worlds Beyond Number with Bitten and Erica and Lou and Apriya that they wanted to make that kind of thing. And I love podcasts. I love actual play. I think that they're wonderful and amazing things. And I wanted to take a show that other people might dismiss or would normally be made without ambition and give it like as much care and ambition as possible. Kind of just to see if it would work, kind of just to see what would happen, but also like as a love letter to the work, like as a love letter to the genre, to the medium even, right? When we sat down to record episode 1, you know, we started with the cast saying, hey, this is my name. This is what I've done before. We're going to tell you a story using a tabletop role-playing game. We roll dice to decide, you know, what gets to happen. And let's go around the table and describe our characters a little bit. And if you look at our feed, it's very clear. We that's not the way episode one starts. Episode one starts the same way a TV show does or a movie or a book does, with the story. That's all you need. I think that these kind of shows can make stories and make art and make compelling fiction at a level that is as high as movies, TV shows, books. And they, those things, take themselves seriously enough to just start at the start. They don't feel the need to apologize and explain themselves first.
And as you started to conceive of the show, before that first episode, and even like throughout the first arc of the show, what were the musical inspirations that the cast came to you with? And what were the musical inspirations that you started with and then kind of developed over the course of the show that became the sound of Worlds Beyond Number?
The cast had two playlists. There was a playlist of songs that they thought would actually appear in the world. And there was a playlist of songs that were sort of vibe-based of like how they were thinking of their character and things like that. The one that was the most useful for me was the one of songs they thought would appear in the world. And what they had imagined was not a big romantic orchestral thing. It was much more intimate. It was much more modern. A lot of Americana was in there. And you absolutely hear that, especially with Ame, with the witch character, with Erica's character, which is just like these pizzicato violins. And the first music we hear of her is an adaptation of an old American folk tune. And the song is so old, it doesn't have one name. It has like six different names. And one of them is Throw That Pig's Foot a Little Closer to the Fire. <It's> the and on the soundtrack, that's called Pig's Foot Pizzicato. And so, yeah, so that slice of Americana sort of comes in, which I think comes from, you know, it's much, that sort of music is much more intimate and much more, it's at a much more human scale than like a big romantic orchestral cue or anything like that, which is a really wonderful place to start. Brennan and I, before production ever began, talked endlessly about the story, the setting, the characters, the vibes. And one of the important questions I asked him was, what is the level of technological development of this setting? Is this like a classic fake medieval period setting? Do they have flying cars? What are we talking about here? And the reason why is because, you know, there are some sounds that listeners will tolerate for everything. You know, big orchestral string swells, people will hear that in any genre, and it's absolutely fine. They don't even realize they're hearing it. But there are other sounds that don't. One of the questions I asked Brennan was, could this world produce a piano? Does this world have advanced manufacturer and like replaceable, machinable parts necessary to create a piano? That tells me, you know, what is the level of music we might hear in that world? That's really important. And I think that talking about that with Brennan, about the piano specifically, sort of led me to one of the big discoveries musically for the show, which is that the piano was going to be the representative instrument of Suvi, one of the central characters of the show. And I think a character whose arc exemplifies the overall arc of the first chapter. And of course, that led us to another big sort of creative decision, which is that the various instrument families of the orchestra were going to represent the different characters and the different sort of factions and ways of looking at the world that the characters represented. The witches would be scratchy strings, you know, plucked. I would imagine the way a witch is like sprinkling things in a pot or picking, you know, herbs in a garden to make something. It's the same sort of motion that you would play pizzicato, cello, or violin. And of course, you know, violins were made with cat gut, and there's nothing witchier than the turning the guts of a cat into music. I mean, that is a spell in and of itself. And the spirit world, I mean, even the word, I think, spirit is also, you know, shares the root with aspiration, aspire, respiration, breath. And so I wanted to have spirits be the woodwinds, you know, the reeds, literally breathing across a reed in a swamp. It seems like a very spiritual thing to me. You get so many wild sounds out of reeds as well. If you mistreat them, they do all these crazy things. And if you look at a lot of the recordings of reeds that we use for the show, you can hear the breath of the person playing it. In going back and remixing and mastering all the music for the soundtrack release, I found all these cuts. And I think that if you were using these recordings in a pop environment, like, you know, a film score or whatever, you would try to take that breath sound away. It doesn't, because it doesn't sound musical. You can hear the literal air moving through the instrument. There's no tone to it, but I kept all of it. And it's very prominent in parts, and that works out great for me because the spirits are the breath of the world. And then, of course, whereas Suvi, who is a wizard from the Citadel, has as her representative instrument the piano, the Imperium in the Citadel itself is represented by horns. And one of my big questions to Brennan early on was, can this civilization, like, dig up metal and make a bugle? Like, would they make a trumpet? And the thing you got to understand is there's a big revelation at the end of book one of The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One about the Empire, about the Citadel and what its aims actually are. And I wanted to reflect that in certain choices from the very beginning. And so I thought it was very appropriate to have for the Imperium, for the Citadel, to have brass be the defining instrument of that sound, because it is very much people digging up precious metals from the earth and reshaping it into something else that has this sort of mathematical button up, button down binary quality that is very much like taking something precious, something that looks gold, and reshaping it for your own ends. You know, brass is associated with epicness and legacy and size and scale and grandeur. You know, even though a big string swell sounds grandiose, but for some reason, I don't know why, something about brass tells people that, like, something is big and important, and that is exactly what the Empire wants to tell you about itself.
GameFound is inviting you to participate in their second RPG Party, a curated event designed to help indie TTRPG creators bring their projects to life through crowdfunding. Whether you're working on a zine, a 600-page collection of tomes, or something more esoteric, this is a unique opportunity to move forward with real support, visibility, and expert feedback. Applications will be reviewed by a panel of judges from GameFound and industry partners like Darrington Press, Modiphius Entertainment, Free League Publishing, and Magpie Games. 15 to 25 projects will be selected to receive workshops with industry experts, marketing support, one-on-one mentorship, and a community of fellow designers to grow together. Open call for submissions lasts from May 5th to 26th, and crowdfunding goes live this fall. Let this be the push you need to manifest your game in the physical realm. It's going to be challenging, there's going to be stress, and if you're able to put in the work, it's going to be so incredibly rewarding. Go to gamefound.com/blog for more information and to submit your project today.
This episode was brought to you by the World Builders Club, a project of Working Families Power, an organization building power for the multiracial working class. The World Builders Club is your go-to dispatch for breaking down the political, cultural, and emotional architecture behind your favorite universes. From romantasy novels and TTRPGs to blockbuster franchises and indie gems. This isn't just pop culture analysis. It's a love letter to the art of creating worlds and the power those worlds have to shape our own. I'm a huge fan of post-apocalyptic world building, so I recommend starting with their piece, We Can't Stop Watching the World End, which talks about properties like GLaDLands, Fallout, and Silo, and what they have to say about humanity and our ability to imagine a world after the apocalypse. But any piece on World Builders Club is going to be a great read for those of us who love to imagine better worlds. So join the club and build a better world with them by subscribing at bit.ly/WBC Many-Sided or by searching World Builders Club on Substack.
Hey, you! You don't look familiar. First time in this part of the city? I see that sneer on your face. Better wipe it off before I do it for you. This is home. This is the best place you could ever want to be. Whether or not this is where you meant to end up, you found yourself on a rather fortuitous street. You see that corner building down there? 3 floors up. Lamplight Investigative Services. Friends of mine, you ask. Loaded words you're throwing around this evening. Good people is what they are, though. Not a single one of them will admit to being nice. Something about duty, yada yada. A bunch of BS, if I do say so myself. Who am I? No need to worry your pretty little head about that. I'm sure my name will come up in time. But go. See for yourself. 3 floors up. Gold-gilded sign. As for Mama, don't tell him I sent you. She'll know what to do.
All doors are just windows that we can't see through. You ever think about that?
We provide our patrons with anonymity.
Hello, this is Mama Amoretta speaking.
Lamplight Investigations, a Thirsty Sword Lesbian's noir mystery. Full season available now on Queer PG.
So we're going to be talking about a couple of different songs that shows kind of the change in your growth as a composer throughout this process of making this first book of Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One. The first song is Flight to Haverward. Where do we first hear Flight to Haverward in the story?
We hear Flight to Haverward for the first time in episode 16. It was the second episode of the second chapter. So chapter 1 ends with this big conflict, this giant climax, this big kaiju battle in this little fishing town. And then Season 2, Chapter 2, Book 1, we open and Ame, the witch character, is unconscious. She's having these flashbacks. But the rest of us, the other characters and the audience, really, are in the Citadel. When Ame awakes, the whole show, the audience, all of us are in the Citadel. And the Citadel is this giant needle-like tower of crystalline glass in the middle of a vast expanse of white desert. It is a huge tower, like a half a mile or a mile wide at its base, and in this tower are enormous floating islands that spiral up and down in this like double helix pattern on the inside of the tower. The Citadel is a combination military base, college, and college town. So on these floating islands is like the military base college where all the wizards of the empire live, right? The 24 courts of the Citadel, and they have these big floating islands. And at the bottom, on the ground, like filling the base, there is a city called Haverward where all the civilians live. That's the college town. That's the industry town. You know, that's where all the normies live that prepare the food and fix the statues and make the bricks and all these things. All the accountants and podcasters live down there in Haverward. Season 1 of the show ends with a big climax. We get to experience some true grandiose stuff, right? Big finish and some really fun stuff along the way. But it takes place out in the boondocks. You know, the biggest town we're in is this little town called Port Talon, which is, a town big enough to support a little organized crime, and that's it. But now we're in the heart of magic in the Kimsarazan Empire, right? We are in the most advanced magic place in Brendan Mulligan's magnum opus fantasy creation. And so the scale jump, the leap, the interval of what we've experienced so far to what we are now in is tremendous. And the song Flight to Haverward occurs when Ame, who has been unconscious for a month, gets a whirlwind tour of the Citadel by the other characters. And so they show her their favorite cafe. They show her, they take her to the top. She's on one of the floating islands. We first see the Citadel when she's, through her eyes, when she's on the top island looking down beneath all of it. And a song called View from the Top plays. It's great, you know, all this stuff. But then we go on a tour. And Flight to Haverward happens when they board a flying contraption called a Galathopter, which is like a big kayak with huge mechanical dragonfly wings. And they begin flying through the Citadel down to this liminal metropolis where this high magic, bonkers, like almost science fiction level of magic is occurring, where it meets the mundane, bustling metropolis down at the bottom, where you have the docks that where these giant floating islands land and get new supplies. And you have these giant portals that are constantly open with people teeming in and out of them to other great cities of the empire and foreign lands. And so Flight to Haverward is supposed to be a knockdown, drag out fight to get you to experience wonder. Now, you know, like the whole thing of the show is like the Citadel, good or bad. And eventually we find out. So the Citadel is very much me and Brennan's love letter to the things we like about New York. The Citadel and Cairo, which is another city in the empire, are sort of like the two sides of New York. And one is this just like wonderful, decadent, high-tech metropolis that contains everything in the world at your fingertips, that is just like constantly blowing your mind every corner you look around. And that's the feeling we wanted to get across. There's no moral complexity to this. There is no, this is the beautiful beating heart of the high-tech empire as it wants you to experience it. So at this beat in the story, your characters are literally, they're not literally on rails, but they are in a public transportation vehicle, which is, that is perfect. As a DM, that's what you want. Because as they're taking this trip, you get to launch into one of the best descriptions you've ever written. And we hear Brennan begin to describe the Citadel and the grand city at Space Haverward. And so I thought, this is the time. Let's knock their socks off. Go. That's, I want you to fill that in your taint. That is, you know, that is for the root chakra. That bass note there is for the root chakra. These are feelings that we had not experienced in the show yet. Season one, everybody was under such duress almost all the time. And this, someone online I saw call this episode a shopping episode, and that really offended me. They do buy it. They buy some snacks. But this is incredible world building episode. And it also, it's something that you just don't get to do very much in these situations, which is have fun. The characters are hanging out and partying, and they will later in the episode, but now we're seeing this through Ame's eyes, right? Ursulon and Lou and Abria's characters have been there for a month. Suvi grew up there her whole life. Abria's characters grew up there her whole life. But Ame is seeing this for the first time. And so the audience is seeing it through her eyes. And so I wanted to make this piece that wasn't like anything we'd heard before. And so it is upbeat. It is, and like we've had happy songs on the show before, but this is big happy. This is big wonder, not mystery and wonder, pure amazing wonder. Joyful. It's supposed to be joyful. This is a victorious moment. It's also the most modern thing we've heard so far in the show. We've had some like jazzy moments a little bit. Earlier in this episode, there's a little sort of jazzy waltz at like a coffee shop, but this one is much more modern. So if you listen to that sound clip, you can hear that there's like there's a wood block that almost kind of that's being hit four on the floor. Just one, two, three, four. That is a technique that I wholly ripped off from John Adams, the American minimalist composer. So I wanted this piece to feel like it is like a piece of 20th century music. So my inspirations were John Adams, A Short Ride in a Fast Machine, Rhapsody in Blue. I wanted it to feel some parts of it like Gershwin. I wanted this to feel like 20th century because they are in a place that is more technologically advanced than anything else they've ever seen. And even though the show does not take place in our 20th century, I wanted to sort of thrust the audience into modernity in the same way that Ame was being thrust to the avant-garde of what the world was doing in the game.
I do think the word wonder is really the thing that this feels like, especially that the second I heard that first bum, 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 bum. That was the moment where I was like, we have arrived.
Exactly.
Like, I know what this city feels like. It feels so alive. It really, that feels like New York to me.
I was also thinking a lot about one of my favorite movies of all time, Wizard of Oz, when they finally reach the Emerald City. Because, like, obviously everything goes down here later. But when they reach the Emerald City, the movie takes a long time to just celebrate it. Brenda and I were talking. It was like, look, we have to spend time loving this place, or else nothing that comes after will be worthwhile. You know, the decision about like what to do with the citadel, the moral question of what do we do about the citadel, is the question of what do we do with our homes? Because you and I live in the fucking citadel, buddy. You know, like we're here. We are in New York. We are at the heart of empire. We are in the imperial core, living and loving and laughing it up. And that question of, you know, the question of what do you do if you are in a society that is evil? Spoiler alert. What do you do if you are part of a machine that is wicked beyond belief, but you live in it? It is your home. That question is only thorny if you also love it. You know, if the Citadel was some big thing that we never fell in love with, the whole show wouldn't make any sense. And Suvi's central conflict wouldn't be a conflict at all. We have to fall in love with the Citadel. Writing this song, and this episode in particular, I think, is really where the show comes into itself. Like the scope and scale of the show, episodes 13, 14, 15, or 16, is the show growing up into what it will become. And I think that this episode, the reason this episode is titled Everything is because, well, first of all, the word is said like 50 times in the episode, but also this episode is everything. We put everything in it.
Here is Flight to Haverward in its entirety with live commentary by Taylor Moore.
I'm doing a panning trick there, like the horns are rotating around you. So cheesy, I really regret it. Totally unnecessary, I hate it.
Oh, I don't mind it.
Okay, good. There's the John Adams block.
I love this. That feels like magic.
That's a John Williams trick. Brown note. Calm space for Brennan talking. This is industry. Men are working, clamping. You hear those like dissonant beeps?
Yeah.
Those are car horns.
Oh, really?
They're meant to be. Yeah, I'll talk about it in a second. Now we're transitioning to another part of the city. Now we're in Haverwood proper. Brennan's doing the bit about the white sand, packed white sand sparkling like starlight. Yeah, using the choir there for that bit was a bit of a stretch because that is a sound we normally reserve for the spirit only. Again, we're back to like a jazzy, busy city. People bustling around. There's a lot of different things happening. And now his description is becoming more general again. At this point, I had learned the pattern of like Brennan's, you know, description, which is great. Like introduction, specifics, summing up. He's very good at it. And so the song gets bigger again. Here comes the climax. Oh, I love those fast trumpets at the end. Yeah, so I mean, the thinking there is section off the theme for the sections of Brennan's description, right? When he's transitioning between locations or features, we get some of the theme, you know, some of the horns come back in and maybe play something like the theme or close to it. And then, but when he gets specific about certain features of Haverwood, we score that feature specifically. In scoring, this is called Mickey Mousing. Mickey Mousing is where every single detail of what's going on gets its own musical accompaniment. It comes from Mickey Mouse cartoons. It's the way they used to score cartoons. But, you know, it has fallen completely out of fashion in modern media. You could even see it in like the 80s and 90s. They would do it in action movies. You can watch, you know, one of my favorite scores of all time, Back to the Future. Alan Silvestri, his first big, cool, great orchestral action score. One of the greatest film scores ever made. It's something I return to constantly. You know, that's a Mickey Mouse score. If you go and watch, you know, when Doc Brown has a realization, you hear the chimes. Like his eyes, his thoughts are literally tied to a very particular instrument playing a very particular set of notes. That's an actual inversion of the main theme. We'll talk about it all day, but we have time. That's the sort of stuff I grew up on. Like, I feel that, like, those Silvestri scores that did that, and the John Williams also would do this. It adds so much. It carved itself into my heart, that way of doing things. And so that's what we do that a lot in the show. We can't do it a lot because so much of composing for audio is underscore, where you are writing music that is meant to be under speech. And so you got to pull it back. You can still do Mickey Mousing. You can even with a sort of ambient texture, even with underscore, you can absolutely have a chord change or the addition or subtraction of an instrument to score very slight and subtle small changes in tone, speaker, information being revealed and all those things. But you always got to keep it in check. But here, every once in a while, even if you're in audio, you got to give yourself the full thing. You got to let yourself do the full thing. And that's what we did here. So every single thing that Brennan's describing has its own correlation to something in the music. When we talk about the deckhands that are working the docks and the cranes moving these buildings around, we have a very modern, syncopated, jazzy feeling of like, right, there's the underpinning of the big, heavy plods. It's almost like big, heavy footsteps, which we hear later when we talk about big golems and constructs walking around helping people. Yes. But, and on top of that are all these like these orchestral percussive instruments. They call them the toys. All these little wood things that sound like, you know, crates landing and chains falling and metal and wood clinking and this sort of semi-musical syncopation. And you get, you know, these very jazzy sort of woodwind parts that sound very modern. And my favorite detail, which is the, you hear these dissonant sort of beep beeps of the woodwinds. Those are meant to sound like car horns. And it's one of those things where there are not cars in this world, but I wanted people to feel like they were on a busy city street. And when you're on a busy street, you hear car horns. And that's another like reference to like Rhapsody in Blue. That's meant to be this like, you know, busy New York City street, people running and crossing the street and all this sort of multifarious chaos going on that nevertheless still feels like it has this underlying melody and rhythm to it. This song also, Flight to Havreward, it was the first time, I mean, musically, it was the most ambitious thing. I mean, there were more tracks and more different sections and things like that. I mean, just completely dwarfs every episode previous in like complexity. But for myself, I'm talking just from my point of view, you know, this is a very simple composition for an actual musician. But for me at the time, this was a huge undertaking. And it was the first time it worked. This was the first time in producing the show and writing music that I felt like I had a vision. I heard it in my head, and then I got pretty close to it. That's a good feeling. I think you ask anyone who makes stuff, the first time that happens, you're hooked. When you have that feeling of like, oh, I made the thing that I heard in my head. Oh no, this is the rest of my life now. I can't ever do anything else. Whoops.
The next song we wanted to talk about was Sarazmir. Can you tell us the first time we hear Sarazmir, where is it both in the story and where is it for you from where you started having zero composition experience to where you are with Sarazmir?
Sarazmir is a very funny example because, first of all, it is a reflection of the Citadel. So Sarazmir is like the Washington, D.C. of the Empire. Like, it is where the actual government, where the reigning family lives. And so while the Citadel is the most important place, Cairo is the cultural capital. The actual capital is Sarazmir. We don't visit Sarazmir until episode 50. And we see it by air. We don't even set foot in Sarazmir. We are in a skyship that is literally dipping into a parade through Sarazmir and then leaving. And it's wild, too, because we're in episode 50 of 54. And in episode 50, we visit the two great cities of the Kimsarazan Empire, the setting of the show. We visit Sarazmir and we visit Cairo in the same episode, in one of the almost final episodes. Like, it's no one would do this, but the story demanded that we do it. We had to do it. The theme for Havreward took me days and days. That's like, what, a two-minute cue? Days and days. I have a week and a half to make an episode. And if I'm spending 3 or 4 days trying to figure out how to write Havreward, you know, how much time does that leave? For episode 50, I've got to write. These are like, these cities demand themes. They have to have giant. These are two extremely important locations. Geographically, narratively, thematically, aesthetically, we have to score the hell out of these things. And they both happen in the same episode in a season which is already twice as long as other seasons with no break. And it already had 12 Brooks and Abyssin, which are these two enormous, giant projects. Each episode, 12 Brooks and Abyssin. 12 Brooks, a two-parter, huge, like, feature film level productions. And now we're going to, episode 50, we've got to go to the two capital cities of the Empire. Well, one of them is Sarazmir. But Sarazmir, Brennan describes it as we approach Sarazmir, he says that the ruling families of the Empire, when they saw what the Citadel had done, when they saw the Citadel had created these giant floating city islands inside this great crystal tower, the rich people were like, and you'll do that for us as well? And so the ground of Sarazmir are all these like weird holes, these perfectly round lakes, because the rich people have paid the wizards to cut out islands from the bottom, and now they're floating. But they're stationary islands floating above ground, and they're all connected by these like concrete and wood roads Because, you know, the wizards aren't going to stick around and make them rotate like at the Citadel. The Citadel's the real show. But the rich people wanted their simulacra of it, right? The rich people wanted their replication of it. And so when I was thinking about Sarazmir, I'm thinking about McMansions. I'm thinking about the Trump aesthetic of how it's all like gold lame, gold paint. It's cheap, rich. So I'm thinking like Las Vegas. So the theme for Sarazmir is a growth of the royal imperial theme that we hear earlier. It's a song called Gold Brocade on the soundtrack, where Suvi meets the prince of the Imperium for the first time and sort of is smitten by him. We hear that theme again, although it's blown out now to comical proportions. And so this song, it sounds enormous, and it might sound complicated to a listener, but it's the simplest thing in the world. It's just, I mean, you know, to get into the music theory for a second, it's just octave stacks. It's a few very simple ostinatos and theme lines just stacked in octaves to make it sound impressive. It is a superficially pretty and grand piece of music, but there's nothing going on beneath the surface. It is pure self-narrative. It's pure propaganda. It is exactly what the House of Saraz wants you to think when you think about them. It's such bullshit. I love it. It's total fake. All the things I overuse the most are overused most on this song. You know, harps are cliche, but they're cliche because they work. They just work. It's just the same thing over and over again, right? It's like McMansion hell. It's just the same thing with slight variations, the same gaudy, rich, saccharine, treacly thing stamped. So we know that we're talking about a city that lives up in the air. So we're going to do, and of course I do this in every big cue, we're going to do a big, full upward gesture orchestral sweep. And Brennan got real low and ended a paragraph with, "and took to the skies they did." Which is just like, you know, as a media composer, you are living for lines like that. That's why he's the king. Is like he's just great at these extremely evocative, well-delivered lines that perfectly set up a big cheesy upward orchestral sweep. In addition, we first hear it when Suvi meets the Grand Imperial Prince, and she becomes immediately smitten, like without him saying a word, like just his presence. And so this is perfect again, where the audience is seeing Sarazmir for the first time. They're now being smitten with this, you know, this beautiful facade, but in a much grander way. What I was trying to do is something that you can't do with library music, and you can't do unless you pay a lot of attention and put a lot of hours in, and AI can't do it, which is build the tone, build the themes. I am not saying this is a great work of art, but someone once told me, I read, or maybe it's a famous quote, I don't know, that like good art or a good movie teaches you how to watch it, or a good book teaches you how to read it. You know, like every work of art like kind of teaches you how to see it if you're open to it. And when you're making something this long, you have a giant opportunity to apply theme and repetition and mood and tone over and over again. And every time you do that, you're putting a coin down, you're putting a chip down, right? And then you have this giant pile and then you get to cash it in. So if you've been with the show for 50 episodes, I can just have a single sound play and you know a certain character has entered behind the hero without them seeing. You know, like you can, I can do things that are impossible if we haven't spent 50 episodes of extremely intentional sound together, because everything is so very intentional and fussed over that enables us to do things artistically that are impossible otherwise. Well, that's the hope. I hope, you know, people drag me, I'm not meaning to sound grandiose. Everything I'm saying like this is aspirational. Like when I talk about theme and like trying to put the chips down and cash them, that is what we hope to do. Like if you're able to do that, if one is able to do that, it's sheer luck. But that's the dream, is to be able to put enough attention in to where those mechanics do come into play and you have done the work well enough over those episodes to then build it to something terrific.
So there are two major cities that we visit in episode 50, Sarasmir, and the second is Karo. Tell us a little bit about Karo.
I was exhausted, Brian. This is after 12 Brooks, after Abyssin. We'd already gone longer than any other book without a break. Had a couple of like week long or more episode delays. I was running absolute exhausted. And now Axis Mundi drops. Axis Mundi is the name of episode 50. So of course, Axis Mundi means the axis of the world or the center of the world, or literally the cross of the world where things cross. Named that because we have Suvi visits Sarasmir, the capital of the empire. Ame, Erica's character, visits Karo, the great Gotham city of the world, of the Kamsarazan Empire. Meanwhile, Lou's character, Ursulon, is going to a literal crossroads to meet the man in black, the stranger. And, you know, also, we are getting to very much the climax of the story. And if you know your Joseph Campbell, if you know your comparative mythology, the climax of the hero's circle takes place at Axis Mundi, the center of the world. It's very important, you know, mythologically for us, when we atone with the father, when we had this great breakthrough of the climax, or in this case, atone with the mother, we do so in a geographic, a physically important place. And so these locations, even though we only pass through them, are very important for the world. And of course, Ursulon is literally going to meet a god at the crossroads. So it felt appropriate to call it Axis Mundi, the center of the world. And the center of the world in our world is, of course, New York City. Hey, baby, we love it. And that is Karo. Karo is everything we love, but we're not proud we love about New York. You know, the crime, the giant human-sized rats that wander the subway tunnels. The fact that the city was built on ley lines by gangsters to summon Nyarlathotep in the 20s, all those things. The inspirations for Karo run deep. And Brennan could talk about this more than me, but we did talk about Karo a lot. And one of the things we kept returning to was New York when it's raining, right? If the Citadel is New York when the sun's out and it's spring or fall, then Karo is rain in February. Citadel is, we're gonna make it after all, and Karo is Gotham City. And, like, we were very much inspired by Tim Burton's vision of Gotham City in Batman and Batman Returns. Batman Returns, one of the best superhero movie, and one of my top 10 favorite movies of all time. And the way Tim Burton envisioned Gotham in those movies is very much inspired Karo. But Karo is also inspired by, you just like gothic-ness, cathedrals and gargoyles, Gormenghast, Victorian London, just this giant arcology of dark, moldy, wet, dank stone with infinite tunnels and basements and parapets and blood-stained cobbles, baby. Let's hear that. Let's roll that beautiful bean footage there, Brian.
Roll that tape.
Yeah, this is the wind-up, right? So all these songs, you know, start with a considerable intro, and then this one ends with a considerable outro in deference to the Dungeon Masters, who need a refractory period after the climax of Karo. just like the Citadel thing, just like Flight to Havermere, each section of the song corresponds to very specifically what Brennan is talking about. The intro was inspired by The Goonies, the score of The Goonies, a little tinkling at the top. I just loved. Just a very, very adventure movie. And then we move into, you know, obviously like the giant entrance. One thing that you'll hear a lot of in this, and also you hear in the Citadel theme, but they're used very differently here, are bells. Giant chimes to evoke the feeling of size, but also cathedrals. Even though, you know, we don't have cathedrals per se in this world, we wanted you to feel like you were in a cathedral. Grand, but also dark and ancient, not like the Citadel. There's a spookiness to cathedrals. They are literally sublime in that they mix wonder with terror, and that's what Kara should be. Also, we get the gargoyles. In the fiction of this world, right, the defining feature of Kara is that it is the site of a civil war between two wizard factions. And me and Brennan talked for a long time about how to represent that in the geography. The city is built architecturally full of gargoyles. Little tiny ones on the roofs, sure, but also giant 10-story gargoyles holding up bridges, you know, lifting up stairs, and like, you know, carved stone gargoyles are built into the giant architecture of the city. And then at the height of the Wizards War, the wizards summons the spirits of these gargoyle statues and brought them to life and used them to kill each other. But then when the war ended, all the gargoyle statues froze in place wherever they were at the time, and that's where they still are. So you can go through the city and like, you might have to like walk under the foot of a frozen 200-foot tall stone monster. Or you might like look in an alleyway and there's a group of gargoyles like hiding around the corner that are frozen and the 200, you know, have been frozen 200 years as if they're about to jump out and kill a wizard. The entire city takes place among these like fossilized remains of these monsters that were summoned during the war. And so, of course, that pairs perfectly with this cathedral feeling. So in this thing, you hear a lot of choir. This is also not like the Citadel in that you hear a fairly traditional thematic structure here where there's an A part of the theme and a B part and a C part. You hear the A part twice and then B and then I think A again. And then we go into this sort of choir fugue. As Brennan is talking about the gargoyles, the choir slowly comes in. As he's wrapping up the gargoyle description, we hear this like weird C part, this fugue that's not connected to the theme in any way. These really strange choir chords come out. And there's this one part where you can hear sort of a tenor sort of breaching like a whale back out of the water before it goes back in. That's my favorite part of the song. It's such a subtle little detail, but I absolutely love it because the way the reverb works and the way the levels work, it sounds like you're actually in a cathedral hearing one guy get a little louder than the rest of the choir. And that makes my heart absolutely soar. There's a couple other things going on with this theme. So every time Brennan changes a focus for his description, we hear a theme, a part of the theme, or an A or a B part, expressed with a different group of instruments. There's a part where he's talking about the wizard war, and you hear a little bit of harpsichord, which at this point, the listeners will remember as associated with a very particular evil man and the faction that he represents. What you don't know when you hear that part of the theme is that in about a minute and a half, we are going to hear full on the harpsichord theme again as we find out that that faction is stationed, headquartered in this city, that Ame has beef with this faction. This has big narrative consequences. And we are now reminded that this city, which we are just passing through for a few minutes, is home to these wicked people with this theme. So it was really important for me to have the harpsichord sneakily come in a little earlier. It's called, foreshadowing, priming. You're laying down a little, hey, does your subconscious mind remember this? Because it's going to come back in about a minute. And that faction is a major part of like the economic and cultural underpinning of the city. They're a part of the fabric of Cairo. There's another great part where I discovered this accidentally, a really great urban fantasy combo, which is you hear the theme is being played by muted trumpets, which you don't hear a lot in like fantasy scoring, right? Like you don't think, oh, Lord of the Rings, muted trumpets. Muted trumpets feels modern, right? It feels like jazzy. And underneath that, so we hear that the muted trumpets are playing the theme, and underneath that are like these swells of contrabass bassoons with tam-tams. Tam-tams are like this giant, like gongs, essentially, like big metal cymbals being rubbed, and like it produces a sort of bassy metal shimmer. And with the bassoon, it makes these like really deep, resonant yawns. Sort of like swells and then go away. And those swells feel ancient and scary and dark and like subterranean and old and big, whereas the muted trumpets feel very like modern and jazzy, which I think it turns out I'm really happy with it because it feels very urban fantasy. Like you smoke a cigarette, get a cocktail, see a show, and then, stop the moonchild from being summoned in a basement of the mayor's house. These two really great things of like old, ancient, big, dark, scary, and also a very sort of modern, jazzy sound, which I didn't see coming. I just discovered it in the making of this cue, but I love it. I definitely recommend anyone else looking for urban fantasy, try bassoon. What a great fucking run of words, too. Contra bassoon, bass, tam-tam. tam-tam, rub, contra, bass, bassoon. That's my activation phrase. Don't say it again. Who knows what I'll do? And then you get the climax, which is sort of the climax, the part right before the climax, the big final swell. You get this wonderful little, everything drops down. Everything's been very big, right? Everything's been very reverberant and large. And then it drops down and you get this solo violin. And this part is meant to make you feel interiority, like you're inside a place, like you're inside a thieves' guild or the big boss's office. Britain says, money and power and intrigue and skullduggery. And that feels to me like that's an interior scene, right? That's much smaller, much more personal. And so I wanted that last bit to feel like you're in a small room and in a great deal of sexy danger. When I heard Brennan perform his Cairo description at the table, and by the way, none of this is a pickup. None of this is recorded after. What you are hearing here is unedited Brennan Mulligan off the top of his fucking dome description. And we had talked about ideas for this. We knew the vibe going into it. But this man is just amazing at this. And when I heard the description at the table, I was standing up. My arms were in the air. I already could hear some of the music I was going to. Like, it was just so perfect. And I knew then it was going to be the most complicated piece of music in the show. And it is. I mean, there's 54 tracks total in this thing, which is not much for some, but for me, that's the most. So I think Cairo actually ended up being the biggest music cue in the show. And it's fitting. Cairo's the biggest city. I think the fundamental thing about The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One, book one, what we did and what we made, and me and the cast and everybody, I don't want to speak for everybody, but I think that this is true. We just wanted to make something with tremendous care and intention. We all love these things, these shows, these actual plays, whatever, games, tabletop, what, all this stuff. We love it all. We love it. But they don't get the love they deserve, you know? Because a lot of us who love this stuff and work in this stuff, we don't have the resources and time to give it. Well, we had the resources and the time. Even though I didn't feel like I had the time a lot of times. You know, we said we're going to give it a shot. We're going to try and do this and put more care and intention and resources into it than anybody ever has. We're going to really try as hard as possible and care and think about every single element. Did that make a great show? I hope so. I don't know. That's for the audience to decide. But I know 100% that we're all better for it. Those of us who tried to make a thing like that. I know it changed my life entirely. Just in the trying.
And now, here is Caro in its entirety.
Thank you.
The original soundtrack for Worlds Beyond Number, The Wizard, The Witch, and The Wild One, Book 1, is available now on Bandcamp. It features well over 100 songs from the show and is on sale now for only $12. If you love this story as much as I do, this is something you absolutely need to have in your collection. Also, a small note from Taylor.
We will not be releasing this music on streaming platforms for a very long time. If you want this music, you can have it, but you must go to Bandcamp and buy it there. It's well over 100 tracks, and it's $12, and this is fun, you actually get the files when you buy the music. So if you want to cut it up, loop it, all that stuff, you absolutely can.
This episode was produced by Brian Flaherty. All the music you hear in this episode was composed by Taylor Moore and is available on the album. Special thanks to Rishikesh Hirway and Song Exploder for the inspiration for this episode.